Here we go. Hey there, folks. This is your host, Cameron Ivey of Privacy Please, and thank you so much for tuning in each and every week. If this is your first time, welcome to the show. Tell your friends about it if you like it. If you don't, let's just pretend you didn't listen to it. Thanks again for coming in, and we hope you enjoy the show. Alrighty then, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another Overreaction Monday with Cam and Gabe. We're here for you. How you doing, Gabe?
Ready to overreact. Ready to overreact. I'm going to channel my inner soothsayer. The salty one for those of you that have been listening. Yeah, I'm ready to overreact. I'm well. How are you doing today? Happy Monday.
Good, man. Happy Monday to everyone. And welcome to another Overreaction Monday. We're ready to dive into this and get some hot takes. So first one we want to talk about is YouTube is facing criminal spying charges for ad blocker detection. That stood out to me, like, that's pretty big. YouTube is one of the biggest, if not biggest, like, I don't even know what to name it. It's like the biggest entertainment streaming platform, for content creators. And yeah, you were going to say something. Sorry.
Yeah, I was say, like, well, let's talk about the naughtiness that's happening here. And when and so, like, because those are big claims, like criminal charges. Facing criminal charges, like what the hell did they do to face criminal charges?
Yeah, let's break that down.
Let's break that shit down. Means. Yeah, so YouTube enabled their ad blocking detection technology. I think they've done this in the past, but I guess they re-enabled it, and you know they're just not allowing anyone to watch YouTube if they're using ad blockers. Now, look, from a privacy and security standpoint, we heavily endorse ad blockers on this show, literally since the first episode. Like, we go down a list of all the things and plugins and whatnots that you can use, from Privacy Badger to AdBlock Plus to running your own Pi-hole or AdGuard. Like, all of the things that you need and you absolutely should do, because ad networks are riddled with privacy-stealing bad guys. Right. And I mean bad guys in both the legitimate sense that they're just, you know, unscrupulous data brokers, and actual bad guys, right? Like using ad networks to deliver malicious JavaScript or anything else. We've seen this is just prevalent in the industry. And so what you're saying, YouTube, is you're asking the general public to walk around unprotected in their browser because your business model cannot otherwise be monetized. Mm-hmm. And so what makes this, well, it hasn't actually been made a criminal, but someone filed a criminal complaint. So a privacy expert filed a criminal complaint saying that their detection scripts, they enable some unlawful spying on EU citizens. So the scripts that they're running to detect if you're doing these things are hooking into your machine and otherwise spying on your machine to know if you are blocking ads. I say kudos. I say the overreaction here was YouTube's to begin with. And quite frankly, I'm ready to overreact to this further and say that organizations like YouTube shouldn't be allowed to use any ad blocking technology, shouldn't be allowed to block you at all by using these ad block detection scripts. And I challenge someone to tell me why. The content is largely not created by them. The platform itself absolutely is. There has to be many other business models that they can figure out how to monetize this. And if there are no other business models that can allow them to monetize it, spying on me as part of your business model is a no-go.
Right. Now, is that Google that's pulling the strings on this spying technology? Do they? You mean, that's my question. I don't know if you know it or either, but does Google own YouTube?
The answer, I believe, is still yes, but yeah. I don't know if they're now their own organization, because like Alphabet owns is the overarching
yeah
org now. So I don't know what their
it's probably a branch that YouTube is under, right?
Yeah. I don't know what the actual structure is, but
because there's a statement in here saying the regulatory authority has sought a response from Google and is waiting for the company to release a statement.
Yeah, that makes sense. So then YouTube is still a subsidiary.
Unless this Hanf's guy that made the complaint or is filing the complaint against the streaming platform, Alexander Hanf, unless he works for Google.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. No. Google is still the owner of.
Okay.
And feels like the kind of thing that you should just know, but like that is how little use their platform to pay attention to it.
Right. Yeah. And the ads are how they make a lot of their money, right? And that's how they pay.
Which is, I hear you. I understand that. If that is your number one revenue source, I don't have an answer for you other than I don't care if your revenue model is tied to invading my privacy.
Right. Is there a way to not invade the privacy and still get, you know, win-win for both sides?
there are companies that have done it before, and there are companies that continue to do it now. There are absolute ways that you can monetize your business without violating people's privacy. There's ungodly numbers of ways. We cover them on this show on a regular basis. We have experts on that are champions for, advocators for, and technology creators of platforms that help enable these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's ways to do it. There's ways to do it. Is there motivation?
Mm. There's always got to be something.
Perverse incentives sometimes, right? Like the perverse incentive here may be to continue to violate people's privacy because like, whatever, we'll just fight this BS little criminal complaint.
Okay.
I call bullshit though. I think YouTube should stop.
No, they're not going to.
No.
It's part of the algorithm. It's part of the way they make money.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to the next one. This is interesting, and I wanted to talk about it with you because I'm not sure if all of our listeners think about this day to day, but your phone is the key to your digital life. Make sure you know what to do if you lose it. Have you ever thought about what happens when you lose your phone, it breaks, or, you know, we lose all internet connectivity and you can't use your phone? Like, do you have a plan? Like, are you that person? A lot of people nowadays have their Apple Pay, banking, everything through their phone. Can you remember someone's phone number? it's not in your phone. I can probably tell you, no, I don't actually know that, which is not good, but it started to make me think, like, maybe I should start planning for that just in case.
Your phone is almost a digital copy of you in so many ways, right? Like, it is.
Yeah.
It is you. It's your recordings. It's who you speak to.
Photos.
It's your photos. It's your life. If you're using two-factor authentication for any services, commercial or private services, it's interconnected with that. It's likely have your email as well too, which is just a primary mechanism. I think you can look at this two ways too, though. Like, have you ever lost your phone?
Me personally, no. I'm pretty good about
destroyed. It. You ever destroyed it? Got smashed? Nothing.
No, I'm pretty good with it.
What do you do when you buy a new phone?
What do you do when you buy a new phone? Get a case and a screen protector?
Technically the truth. Yeah. Like, but how do you get data from your old phone to your new phone?
Oh, from the cloud, of course. I mean, that's what's really nice about Apple, because if you have a Mac, you can pretty much do everything on your Mac that you can on your phone.
Yeah.
You can make calls, FaceTimes. You can't just, you just, you know, obviously.
So, yeah, Androids have that too. So for the most part, a lot of phone folks, I think, have their phones. A lot of folks have their phones backed up to the cloud today.
Right.
That brings with it two massive challenges. There's the privacy challenge. Like all of the things about you are up in the cloud, which means theoretically someone could clone your phone, bring all that information.
Sure.
Like we can already clone your IMEI numbers. Like those types of attacks already exist. So I can clone your phone and make phone calls as you, intercept 2FA calls as you, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I were to equally then get access to your cloud backup, like now I just have a phone that's you. I'm just Cameron. From like an attack path perspective, the first step in that even is if I were able to clone your IMEI and or get to your primary email address, the rest of your digital life as it exists in your hands would now be mine. I could completely mirror that thing. No, I know most people don't think about what happens if these kinds of things happen. I can certainly tell you, like, my parents don't think about it, right? Like, they don't really think about it. But if mom were to lose her phone, she'd just go down to the store and log back in, and and the things would sync. You make a good point about remembering phone numbers. I only know two phone numbers by memory. Two. One of them is my childhood phone number, which is still the same.
Mine's not, but I do remember that phone number.
The same woman will answer on the other end of that. That's when I was a child.
That's good.
And yeah, the other one's my significant other, right? Like I know those two phone numbers.
Yeah, that's
the only two I know.
All you need.
Hopefully.
Roughly.
If I need more than both of those, shit's rough. It's really, really, really tough. But
yeah,
I think that's the other answer, is have a plan for like what are the two numbers, three numbers. Hell, if we're being honest, we could memorize more than that. Humans are capable. Back in the days, we all did it. We memorized more than like two or three or four or five numbers, right? Like,
yeah.
I could tell you like 10 of my friends' phone numbers, no problem. But it's like I would choose two.
And then when that happens, though, and you have to make a phone call, let's just put ourselves in a situation where it's late at night and there's not many people around. What are you going to call from for an emergency? Asking somebody on the street may be really...
I'm trying to figure out how the hell I got here on this.
Like if someone asked me to use my cell phone.
Yeah, you tell them no.
And I don't know them. Like,
yeah, no, it's a hardcore no. Yeah, no.
I'm good, man. I'm good.
No, it's... I would have to have in under seconds seriously evaluated that this person's need exceeded, you know, just my general wariness meter.
Yeah. Just especially because it's late at night. You just like, so I mean, you put yourself in that situation, it might be pretty tough. I mean, you can maybe walk into a business and ask them to use their phone, but I don't know, man.
I don't know.
Bad situation.
It's a bad situation. It's happened in the past. See, the thing is, pre-phones, these things happened. And so now that phones exist, we've basically given away so much of our privacy rights to these other companies, to the cloud.
Right.
So that the cloud can keep me safe when I am not safe anymore.
Right.
There's a whole lot to give up there.
Yeah, I mean, so... Overreaction, underreaction on this. I mean, I think
a little bit of an underreaction.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think my biggest challenge is that, you know, it's the privacy trade-off for what was something that we were able to accomplish for a very long time, right? Like
right.
How to reach other people. I don't like the privacy trade-off of it, but it does beg the question. Maybe there should be some kind of – like they used to be free phone books, right? Like they were like yellow pages. Maybe there should be some way that you can each have an individual free phone book, which is to say it's not – you know, you have your contacts and they're synced with Google.
Right.
So what if the town that you live in, the state that you live in, you know, use some of your tax dollars to give you some kind of a like digital contact, right? Like it's now your own private phone book. It's your own private phone book. And maybe it's paid for the same way old school phone books were paid for. Your local pizza company takes out an ad in there. So like when you're flipping through your contacts, it's your privacy is now preserved, but it's stored in a cloud format that doesn't allow for the organization that holds it to compromise your privacy, but right. delivered back to you as a digital phone book that you can access anywhere, anytime you want.
Interesting.
I'm not building that idea. It sounds like a great idea. Someone else should solve this problem.
Some of you smart people out there, go solve this problem. Thanks.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. All the geniuses. All right, let's move on to the last one here. This one's pretty big. So how do Americans view data privacy, Gabe? This article is pretty interesting, but
cover this one. I want to say we've covered this body of research a couple of times before. Because I know for a fact that I've definitely pulled from it for different speaking engagements. But the Pew Research Center puts out this yearly, I think it's yearly, when it is yearly, report on how Americans view data privacy and their overall interactions with data privacy. And there are a couple of things that really stood out for me. So Americans are largely concerned and confused about how their data is being used. So 81% of Americans are folks in this research are confused about how companies are using their data. And 71% of folks are confused as to how the government is using their data. That's a lot of people. That's like basically everyone. Like more or less everyone's like, we have no idea how you guys are using our data. Like we just don't get it.
Right.
We just don't get it. By contrast, the people that have little to no understanding about what those organizations do with the data they collect is inverse to that. So about 67% of folks have little, no understanding of what companies do when they get your data. So let's tie those two together. 81% of them are concerned with what they do with your data, and 67% of them have no freaking idea what they do, which is interesting because it means that it means that there's 14% of people that think they have a better understanding of what those companies do with your data, and they're concerned like and that's it. It's like that's a you can start reading into these numbers in very interesting ways. But so again, inverse to the number of people that are concerned, 71% of people are concerned about what the government does when they collect your data, right? About how they use it. But 77% of them have no understanding of what the government does with their data at all, which is kind of ridiculous. 77% are like, yeah, no, the government collects data from me, but I have no idea. And I understand that. I might reflect that quite honestly. Like, I don't really know what either of those two groups are doing with my data. I know what some of them are doing because some of them tell me. I know what some of them are doing because they don't tell me, but because, you know, I've been able to piece it together. A great example of that is like I use very specific emails for every different service I sign up for. So when Washington Post at gabegums.io shows up on other spam lists, like I know where that email came from. It's like you gave it away with the Washington Post or you had it stolen. That's it. Those are the answers. But it's interesting. I mean, what those two numbers suggest is that the better understanding that people have with what they do with your data, the more that they seem to trust what you might do with that data. But ultimately, almost no one trusts or understands what the hell companies or the government is doing with our data. That's what this research says. Like almost no one understands or trusts. And so what does that leave? That leaves like the people that listen to this show. I don't know what percentage of the population we account for, not just this show, but like within the industry, so to speak, like within the privacy industry, in and around everything related to privacy, law, tech, you name it. But by the time you fill in the gaps here, it means 100% of the freaking population has no idea of what's happening.
I'm going to call underreaction on children's online privacy. 89% of Americans are concerned about social media platforms knowing personal information about kids. I think it's
that's a lie. Higher. Well, yeah. I call it a lie. Why did I call that a lie? I mean, the research I don't think is lying. But
No. But I think that number is deceiving.
Very deceiving.
Because it says 85% believe parents hold a great deal of responsibility. I think it should be 100% of parents hold all responsibility for their children's privacy in terms of knowing what the hell depending on their age, but like managing what they're doing on their devices and stuff. Like, you can do that.
I will give you one better, because kids are kids and maybe they, they live in ecosystems.
They're
and
smart.
The other kids are using, the Shellagram, and so now they want three shells also, and they want to use the Shellagram.
Yeah, that's fair.
Shout out to anyone who gets the three shell reference.
Yes,
but that's where the onus is still on the education side of it. Like, teach them, tell them why.
Yeah,
this is dangerous, and I'm telling you not to do it. And I understand you might still do it, and you really shouldn't, and you're an idiot for doing so. And here's exactly what the consequence of doing it will be. Mm-hmm. And show them the why. Like,
don't just say no because I said so.
That's right. Show them the why. Tell them the why.
Yeah, make them understand.
Lead by example.
Mm-hmm. Give them experience that you experienced where someone stole your data.
Example, like, if you have an Instagram account, don't get salty when your kid's on the gram, right? Like,
yeah,
when you have a Facebook account, you should probably expect that your kid maybe not, because I guess old people use Facebook now and young people don't. I don't know how these things go.
Yeah, I guess it's an old person thing now.
Yeah, see, but that's the thing. Like, I have none of these things. And so I would have zero expectation that someone looked at me as some kind of role model and thought to themselves, yeah, it's okay for them to do it, so I'll do it too. Like, yeah. And what is being missed? I don't have an answer for that. Maybe you believe there's some legitimate thing missing in your social interactions that those platforms fill and that you find no ability to replace them with.
Right.
I can think of no such things in my life. So I might be weird. I might be different. But I'm with you. I call underreaction and I call BS. Like, it's on you. It's on you.
Yeah, for sure.
Here's another one, and it ties right to them, right?
Yeah.
So, same research. Many trust themselves to make the right privacy decisions, but are also skeptical that their actions matter. So, 78% of these folks trust themselves to make the right decisions about their personal privacy information. 78. GTFO, not even close. 78% of people trust themselves to make the right privacy decisions. Now, here's why I'm calling the nonsense on this one. Again, I trust the research. I trust that these people think that they're making the right privacy decisions.
Right.
But there is a combination of both. A, it is very difficult for them to even know that when companies are a little obtuse, if not a lot obtuse, about what private decisions you're even allowed to make and how you're allowed to have them affect yourselves. And B, given the sheer number of people that still exist on social media platforms, I don't possibly see how 78% of the population thinks that they can make the right privacy choices for themselves and still participate in what is the most privacy violating of technologies man has ever created.
Good point.
It is akin to saying, I understand how to make the right decisions about drug use while simultaneously smoking methamphetamines. It's like, no, you do not understand how this works. You are doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. That is not how this works.
It's just, since you threw the drug thing in there, can we, is it still not astonishing that family is not in prison?
Which
somewhere?
One? Like, the Sackler family?
The one that's the cause of the freaking pills and, like, I mean, we don't have to go down that hole, but like, it's mind blowing what they have caused.
I watch very little television, but I will tell you, and the rest of the listeners, you should check out The Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix when you get a chance. The mm-hmm. Fall of the House of Usher. I happen to be a big Poe fan, and so that's what sucked me
in. It's on my list.
Yeah.
Their series. They do so many good.
It's so good. But
yeah,
the characters in the show are meant to loosely be based on that family.
Ah, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. But it is a derivative of an Edgar Allan Poe series of work. That's just not
cool.
But yeah, I don't know why those people aren't in prison either.
I guess it can be said about a lot of other people too. So, all right. So implications, Gabe, when it comes to a lot of this stuff, you know, like growing concerns, trust, deficit, policy implications.
My number one growing concern is, I'll read one more and I'll tell you, nearly 6 in 10 Americans frequently skip reading privacy policies. I believe that number is equally way higher. I think it's higher than six. And B, of those that do read it, like a lot of it's not super clear language, although I will admit that I see a lot of organizations making really good attempts to make their privacy language clear. But the bigger implication here is there's this if I'm interpreting this research the way I think it can and must be interpreted, there's a massive disconnect between how at least Americans view their participation in privacy, their ability to affect their own privacy choices, and their understanding of privacy and privacy choices. I think there's a big disconnect between those things and real world privacy outcomes.
Yeah, I agree. I think to touch on your point before, I think education and awareness has got to be at the top of the
huge
list of just being something that should be highlighted and incorporated in education for, you know, starting young. Privacy practices and awareness about data. 'Cause I think that the lack of understanding across the United States is still severely low, even though people think they understand it.
It is almost completely not existent. It's so low.
Yeah. But I think, there's room to grow there, obviously. I mean, obviously, it can't go any worse than what it's ever been. But I think it's getting better, and there's a lot of room to improve.
Here's the last bit of privacy. I'm just going to read it. So, what percentage of people do you think lock their phones? Like, they use locks, they either use a passcode, a fingerprint, face recognition. What percentage of people?
Well, I already know what it is, but I still think it's a high number compared to, like, considering how low it is, but I think it's still higher than I thought it would be.
Same. Much higher than I thought it would be. It's 16%. Yeah. 16% do not lock their phones at all. It's so easy to do. Like, even the locking, unlocking process, right? Like, it's so easy to do. But as we talked about a few minutes before, your phone being the key to your digital life, you've now concentrated everything to know about you in this one place. And 16% of folks just walk around like, nope. The numbers get a little scarier when you look at the age demographics, though. 65 and plus and better.
Yeah.
28% don't lock their phones at all.
Well, they don't want to forget a number, but you got your face. You're not going to lose your face.
You got your face. You got your finger.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to remember a number.
Make the number something. I'd rather you made it all nines than none at all, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, because like, at least
someone won't try it.
Yeah, and if someone figures it out, it's
you
probably
already,
that
you're already in trouble, like, because you have no password, right? Like,
yeah, because if it's someone that's worried about, like, they're, you know, someone spying on them and what they're researching and stuff, I mean, you got other problems.
You got
if you're worried about your significant other looking into your phone and not trusting you.
That's a much bigger problem that no amount of technology is going to fix. And I suggest you go work on your relationship.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
That is a problem. 16% still don't unlock their phone. Still don't lock their phones and use a passcode.
That's wild. A lot. That's a lot.
Well, I wonder what that number is based off of. Does it say what it's like, how many people it's based off of?
In the methodology section of the research, we'll paste the research for everyone, but it's, the Pew research is amazing, as you might imagine, at, divulging their sources, their methodology, sample sizes, all of that stuff is in there.
Well, I think at a high level, this definitely underscores the complexity, but gives us a good idea. This is pretty cool stuff. And I'll try to do like a summary and put that in the notes for everybody. But anything else you wanted to add before we wrap this one up?
That's it, man. Happy Diwali for those folks that were celebrating this week. And happy Diwali. And we'll catch you guys next time on Privacy Please. Lock your phones. Lock your phones.
Lock your phones.
Hide your kids. Hide your wife. Lock your phones.
And that's how we sign off.
Hey, you guys made it all the way to the end. Thanks for listening. Again, if this is your first time, we really appreciate the support and everyone that's always been around since the beginning. We love you guys. Keep supporting Privacy Please, and we'll always have new content each and every week. Cameron Ivy, over and out.